There's a small plaque affixed to the old parsonage in the village of Kessel in Switzerland on the southwestern shores of Lake Constance. And on that plaque are inscribed these words: "In this house was born Carl Gustav Jung, July 26, 1875, June 6, 1961. Explorer of the human soul and its hidden depths." That plaque, the words upon it, have long seemed to me the succinct summary of who Jung was, of what he did, and of why he is important. Indeed, in my estimate, one of the most important of modern men. Though few people to this day have understood the fact behind those words, the words are literally true. Literally true. Carl Gustav Jung, explorer of the human soul and its hidden depths. In 1913, C.G. Jung heard a call that bid him take a journey of exploration, a journey rife with mortal danger. He accepted that summons, that vocation. He survived the perils, and he returned with treasures. He devoted the rest of his life to sharing that treasure with an age forgetful of the mystery that by fact and burden of a great journey he knew, he had witnessed. A journey that lasted from around the ends of 1913 until around 1918, the time of the Great War. His journey crossed over the surface boundaries of the world known to most women and men. With focused intent and with enormous concentrated effort, he excavated down to a lost and long forgotten passageway that led to a land of hidden wonder and terror. For about 4 years, he ventured into that twilight realm. C.G. Jung explored the mystery of the human soul and its hidden depths. The work of Jung in the long remainder of his life, after that journey, was dedicated to sharing the discoveries he had made. In his many essays, in his commentaries, he gave us maps of the terrain he had encountered. But the precious diary of the journey, Liber Novus, the Red Book, the record he spent 15 years transcribing and illustrating, remained his private treasure. In his life, it remained mostly hidden, and after his death, it was withheld from public view or study. I say again, the Red Book, the book Jung called, as inscribed on its spine, Liber Novus, the New Book, or the Book of the New, is the journal of an adventure of exploration to the hidden depths of the soul. And now finally, it has passed from his hands into ours. He has given us, many decades after his death, the record of that journey. In this short series of introductory lectures, I can only read you a few passages of the Red Book, offer little glimpses. I cannot give the book a quick general summary. Indeed, I think it's beyond the ability of anyone to do so. and I cannot give you any brief exegesis, summary commentary on its meaning. Jung himself gave that exegesis. The first layer of that interpretation exists within the strata of the book itself. The second exegetical layer takes form in the sum of everything C.G. Jung wrote after 1916, after his journey had begun. Several million words in the collected works of Jung circle back to an unseen source, the Red Book, Liber Novus. Jung said, "All my works, all my creative activity has come from those initial fantasies. All. I've spent the last 3 or so months since receiving my copy of the book reading and rereading it many, many times. And now scattered in my office are most of the collected works of Jung, turned open to the various signal passages that I had long thought must point back to this. And as I've read and reread his later works, I find that indeed what he said is true. All of his works, all of his creative activity starts here, points here to Liber Novus." Tonight I direct myself to a single task, and that is helping you understand the Red Book as what it was, the journal of an experience, a lived experience. Understood in that way, in those terms, as the diary of a journey of exploration, I think your own reading will be greatly enriched. And perhaps you'll find the account of Jung's journey inspiration to embark upon your own reconsideration of the mystery of the human soul. Explore. Explore. In my own life, I've been captivated by that image. Once in my younger life, I had my own desire to explore, to find the edges of the world, the last blank places on the map. And I became fascinated as well with old maps, maps where there were still blank places, unseen, unknown. In some of those medieval maps, one finds sketched the known area of the world, more or less correctly. As one moves out from that center of conscious human activity, of common passage, the contours of the maps start to dissolve into less and less precise boundary lines. They become more and more fantastic, more conceptual, imagined. And then, there at the boundaries of some of these old maps, one in particular I'm thinking of, one will often find the words, "Ultima Thule," Ultima Thule, the ends of the earth. And there, one often will find inscribed fantastic beasts. On one of the maps, underneath the words Ultima Thule, appear the words, "There be dragons. There dwell dragons." As I think of Jung as an explorer, I think of him in just these terms. The young man, the young Jung, grew up on the borderlands of the edges of the known. From his earliest years, he felt motions communication coming from beyond the edge of conscious human perception, in dream, and, as I related last time in our lecture, in visions. That sense of a fullness, of a wholeness, of a completeness, of which he had part, carried with him into his adolescent years. They motivated him to the natural sciences, and then to medicine, and then to his choice of a specialty in the new, revolutionary, unknown, investigatory realm of modern psychiatry. He was probing at an unknown realm in the soul, in the psyche. There were no maps, you see. No maps in that day and age of what he sought to know. He was trying to build maps through his investigation, through his interaction with patients, through his observation of the mysteries of the psyche. And he began to build those theoretical maps. He met a man much older than himself by the name of Freud, who came to him with a map, a theory, a theoretical construct of what existed in the ultima thule, beyond the edges of our consciousness, in that last realm, beyond the known. He became almost a religious convert to that theory for a few years, around age 31, 32, through perhaps age 35, 36. And then he discovered, in his observation both of himself and of his patients, that the map was wrong. The map suggested that that ultima thule, that last borderland of consciousness, was ringed really by a midden pile, shall we say, a trash dump. That all that was there, well, were things, fragments, shards of our pains and experiences, our repressions of instinctualities. Oh yes, they stank, that midden pile, that trash heap, that dunghole of the unconscious, it stank. It stank with the half-digested refuse of our lives. It needed a cleaning, maybe even an exploration, a salvage operation. But that was not Jung's perception. From his own experience as a child, as a young man, from his own interaction with his patients, with human beings, women, men, caught halfway or wholly across the borderland, blown by the winds of the psyche, he knew that that was not just a trash heap. He had sensed in his youth a breeze blowing from a distant sea with sweet savors of the unknown. He saw in the psychosis of his patients motifs of ancient mythologies, God stories. He came to sense that the stories themselves, the God stories, had blown in, had come across, had been brought by messengers who had crossed the borderland of the known, who had gone to the ends of the earth and crossed beyond. There was value there. He sensed not only in the psyche, in the soul, in the unknown, in the unconscious, was there pathology. There was also a mystery of healing, a mystery of wholeness, seeking recognition. He said in summary of his youthful experiences, I felt at some time or other I had passed through the Valley of Diamonds, but I could convince no one, not even myself. When I looked at them more closely, that the specimens I had brought back were not mere pieces of gravel. In 1913, Jung was forced, by fact of his experience as a physician, by honesty, to throw aside the irrelevant map drawn by the science of his age, drawn by the theoreticians he had known and called comrade at one point, theories about the nature of the soul. And he had to accept it was still an unknown realm. His life was one of trouble. He had reached a dead end. He was severing his professional associations from the psychoanalytic movement because he knew the theory was wrong. There was something more. Something more. He was troubled by portentous dreams, dreams that he could not explain. A dream of a medieval crusader appearing in a southern town under the high noon sky, wearing golden armor with a cross, a Maltese cross, the symbol of the ancient Templar order, upon his armor. A dream of a bird suddenly appearing on a green emerald table before him and transforming into a maiden, announcing that she could only appear when the 12 were away with the male dove. Dreams that simply he could not interpret by any method, by any theory, or by the pathways inscribed upon any map he knew. He felt something inside of him trying to come out, trying to reach consciousness, and he knew if he would understand the soul, the human soul, well, he had to go there. He had to go into the realm of the psyche. He had to explore for himself. If he was going to have a map, it would be a map drawn by experience, by his experience. He had to do it. Oh, but how? How? That how we'll talk about tonight. The Red Book consists of several layers, layers of structure. In the first layer of the Red Book, there is the diary of Jung's exploration, a diary kept carefully night by night, dated. He compiled that diary after the original events, about a year after the original events, and added to that first layer, which is a fairly precise transcription of his diary entries, a layer of interpretation, reflection. And then came a third layer. As time passed, he felt a need to take this record and place it into a precious book. That is the Red Book. The manuscript hand traces the words he had written in draft. The pictures, the illustrations, he added over years. After completing the draft of the Red Book in around 1916, he labored for 13 to 15 additional years creating this volume, the Red Book volume. Instead of my trying to give you further introduction to the Red Book, at this point, let's let the Red Book speak for itself. Jung gives this introduction. This is the first page of the Red Book, penned by Jung in 1915, after the completion of the first phase of his journey of exploration. The title at the top, The Way of What Is to Come. The first page begins with three prophetic readings taken from the Old Bible. Isaiah dixit, in Latin. It starts, Isaiah said, "Who hath believed our report? And to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of a dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness. And when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised. We esteemed him not. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we did not esteem him stricken, smitten of God, afflicted." Unto us a child is born, and unto us a son is given. And the government shall be upon his shoulders, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Next, a reading from the Gospel of John. Johannes dixit, John said, and the Word was made flesh, and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. And a final reading again from Isaiah. The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice, even with joy and singing. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap as a hart, and the tongue of the dumb sing. For in the wilderness shall water break out, and streams in the desert. And the parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water. In the habitations of dragons where they lay shall be grass and reeds and rushes. And an highway shall be there, and a way, and it shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for those, the wayfaring men. Fools shall not err therein. At the very bottom, in small letters, in Latin again, the words, written by C.G. Jung with his own hand in his house in Kunstnach, Zurich, in the year 1915. As Dr. Shyam Dasani says in his commentary, Jung starts with a prophetic tone. Why he chose those three old prophetic readings? Well, I'll leave that to your consideration. It's worth considering. A way, a highway, a path, a road, a desert, blooming with water, a place of dragons, become habitable, a despised and ugly man, rejected, a word, become flesh. Perhaps to Jung those words played at the mystery he was walking, the highway he was now exploring. Jung continues. Page 2 of Liber Novus. And here he gives introduction his summary, his address to the reader, you, who come to this text now. He attempts to explain what he is doing. If I speak in the spirit of this time, I must say, no one and nothing can justify what I must proclaim to you. Justification is superfluous to me, since I have no choice, but I must. I have learned that in addition to the spirit of this times, there is still another spirit at work, namely that which rules the depths of everything contemporary. The spirit of this time would like to hear of use and value. I also thought that way, and my humanity still thinks that way. But that other spirit forces me, nevertheless, to speak beyond justification, use, and meaning. Filled with human pride and blinded by the presumptuous spirit of the times, I long thought to hold that other spirit away from me. But I did not consider that the spirit of the depths, from time immemorial and for all future, possesses a greater power than the spirit of this time, who changes with generations. The spirit of the depths has subjugated all pride and arrogance to the power of judgment. He took away my belief in science. He robbed me of the joy of explaining and ordering things. And he let devotion to the ideals of this time die out in me. He forced me down to the last and simplest things. The spirit of the depths took my understanding and all my knowledge and placed them at the service of the inexplicable and the paradoxical. He robbed me of speech and writing for everything that was not in his service, namely, the melting together of sense and nonsense, which produces the supreme meaning. The spirit of the depths, the spirit of this time. The spirit of this times, what was it? Well, it's not so different now. A consensus reality, a scientific viewpoint, an ordering rationality, sense. It's concerned with what? Value? Oh, most certainly it's concerned with value, especially the value of money. It wishes to order. And by what ordering does it order? The spirit of the depths. It's a voice coming from deep within, from deep below. A spirit, a voice of the unconscious itself, perhaps we might say. A voice from beyond the border of the consensus, rationality of his age, of his science. And it was petitioning him. It was petitioning him to listen. But there's a conflict in him, you see, because he is a man of his time. He's a scientist. He is a physician. A theoretician once upon a time. And the spirit of the times whispered to me, Jung continues, this supreme meaning, this image of God, this melting together of hot and cold, that is you and only you. But the spirit of the depths spoke to me. You are an image of the unending world. All the last mysteries of becoming and passing away live in you. If you did not possess all of this, how would you know? For the sake of my human weakness, the Spirit of the depths gave me this word. Yet this word is also superfluous, since I do not speak it freely, but because I must. I speak because the Spirit robs me of joy and life if I do not speak. I am the serf who brings it and does not know what he carries in his hand. It would burn his hands if he did not place it where his master ordered him to lay it. The Spirit of our time spoke to me and said, "What dire urgency could be forcing you to speak all of this?" This was an awful temptation. I wanted to ponder what inner and outer bind could force me into this, because I found nothing that I could grasp. I was near to making up one. But with this, the Spirit of our times had almost brought it about that instead of speaking, I was thinking again about reasons and explanations. But the Spirit of the depths spoke to me and said, "To understand a thing is a bridge and possibility of returning to the path. But to explain a matter is arbitrary and sometimes even murder. Have you counted the murderers among the scholars?" But the Spirit of the times stepped up to me and laid before me huge volumes which contained all my knowledge. Their pages were made of ore, and a steel stylus had engraved inexorable words in them. And he pointed to these inexorable words, and he spoke to me, and he said, "What you speak, that is madness." It is true. It is true. What I speak is the greatness and intoxication and ugliness of madness. But the Spirit of the depths stepped up to me and said, "What you speak is. The greatness is. The intoxication is. The undignified, sick, paltry dailiness is. It runs in all the streets, lives in all the houses, and rules the day of all humanity. Even the eternal stars are commonplace. It is the great mistress and the one essence of God. One laughs about it, and laughter too is. Do you believe, man of this time, that laughter is lower than worship? Where is your measure, false measurer? The sum of life decides in laughter and in worship, not in your judgment." After this, my humanity remained silent. Something happened to my spirit, which I call mercy. My speech is imperfect, not because I want to shine with words, but out of the impossibility of finding those words. I speak in images. With nothing else can I express the words from the depths. I speak in images. Nothing else can express the words from the depths. That's a good summary of what you'll see, what you'll read, what you'll find in the pages that follow. Jung continues, The mercy which happened to me gave me belief, hope, and sufficient daring not to resist further the spirit of the depths, but to utter his word. But before I could pull myself together to really do it, I needed a visible sign that would show me that the spirit of the depths in me was at the same time the ruler of the depths of world affairs. It happened in October of the year 1913. And he continues. It happened in the year 1913. In 1913, Jung came to the crossroads. It had been 13 years since he graduated from medical school and embarked on a career in the revolutionary new field of psychiatry. In those short years, he had risen to international prominence as a researcher, clinician, clinical theoretician, author, and lecturer. He had a thriving private practice. But at age 38, crowned with success and honor, Jung found himself destitute in an interior desert, without a map. He felt this spirit of the depths rising in him, and he wondered if he would go mad. In 1913, amidst this turmoil of mind, of psyche, he was riding on a train to his mother-in-law's house, a ride of about an hour, I believe. He had a book in his lap, and suddenly he saw a vision. He saw not a book. He saw a sea. A turbulent, swarming sea rising up from the north and covering all of Europe, up to the mountains of his home of Switzerland, which rose up in protection. In that flood was the debris of civilization and floating bodies. This was October of 1913. A few weeks later, he was taking the same journey again, and the vision recurred. This time, he notes, it was more amplified in its terror. The blood, the sea of blood, was more vivid. The death and destruction, more sure. He was nauseated. He was disturbed. He was fearful. He said at the time that as a psychiatrist, as an analyst, well, I could see destruction was coming. And if I were to make a diagnosis, the diagnosis was I was totally off. He was afraid that he was menaced by a psychosis. The man had taken care of psychotic patients in one of the finest institutions of Europe, the Berg-Holsley Hospital, as a resident. He had 13 years of experience as a psychiatrist, and he had had a devastating vision, an hallucination, an open vision of destruction. He went into a period of analysis, trying to figure out what was going on, what was happening in him, trying to somehow abort that developing psychotic episode, if that indeed was what it was. He turned to his dreams, to his fantasies. He knew not what to do. He says he went out in his yard and started playing as he had as a child, because it's the only thing that made sense to him. As he dug and dug and tried to understand what it was deep inside him that was trying to bubble up, that was trying to be known and unknown, unapproached, unlistened to, might actually result in his dissolution, in psychosis, in schizophrenia, in madness. He had no map. No map that told him the byways of the road he was walking. Whatever was calling, he knew that he had to meet it. Examination of his dreams led him back to the memory of his childhood, to the memory of an experience he had once had, of a fullness and of a wholeness, of an otherness within. And since this otherness was not fully revealing itself or its intentions, he felt that he needed to address it and ask its intention, understand its source. On the evening of November 12th of 1913, C.G. Jung departed on his exploration. He knew not why. He simply understood that his hand reached into the drawer of his desk, where this journal had rested untouched for 11 years. He took the journal out, a journal in which he had once kept his most private thoughts, a journal that he had abandoned in his years of alienation, in his journey outward to success in the world. He opened it, he took his pen, and he wrote, "Meine Zelle, meine Zelle, wo bist du? My soul, where are you?" One of the most heartfelt petitions of human voice I can imagine. He didn't use the word psyche, the Greek term translated in English as soul. He used that old Germanic word with roots back in the darkness of human experience. Human experience of a soul. My soul. Where are you? Do you hear me? I speak. I call you. Are you there? I have returned. I am here again. I have shaken the dust of all the lands from my feet, and I have come to you. I am with you. After long years of long wanderings, I have come to you again. Should I tell you everything I have seen, experienced, and drunk in? Or do you not want to hear about all the noise of life and the world? But one thing you must know. The one thing I have learned is that one must live this life. This life is the way. The long sought after way to the unfathomable, which we call divine. There is no other way. All other ways are false paths. I found the right way. It led me to you, to my soul. I return, tempered and purified. Do you still know me? How long the separation lasted. Everything has become so different. And how did I find you? How strange my journey was. What words should I use to tell you? On what twisted paths a good star has guided me to you? Give me your hand, my almost forgotten soul. How warm the joy at seeing you again, you long disavowed soul. Life has led me back to you. Let us thank the life I have lived for all the happy and all the sad hours, for every joy and every sadness. My soul, my journey should continue with you. I will wander with you and ascend to my solitude. Private words. This is the Red Book. This is the beginning of the Red Book. These words, inscribed in that diary, dated 12 November 1913, appear just so in the Red Book. It's the beginning. What followed is one of the most remarkable passages in recorded history of human experience. Jung was a scientist. He was an empiricist. Over the years of his professional study of the psyche, he had carefully observed and recorded the psychic processes, as best he could understand them, of many, many hundreds of patients. And he determined that now he would keep a clinical journal, a diary, a ledger of his own self-experimentation, what he would call his most dangerous experiment, his most difficult experiment, his journey in search of his soul. A year later, to this passage transcribed in the Red Book, he added the commentary layer, his reflection, looking back a year hence at what had happened. And he said this: "The spirit of the depths forced me to say this, and at the same time to undergo it against myself, since I had not expected it then. I still labored misguidedly under the spirit of this time, and thought differently about the human soul. I thought and spoke much of the soul. I knew many learned words for her. I had judged her and turned her into a scientific object. I did not consider that my soul cannot be the object of my judgment and knowledge. Much more are my judgment and knowledge the objects of my soul. Therefore, the spirit of the depths forced me to speak to my soul, to call upon her as a living and self-existent being. I had to become aware that I had lost my soul." From this we learn how the spirit of the depths considers the soul. He sees her as a living and self-existing being. And with this he contradicts the spirit of this time, for whom the soul is a thing dependent on man, which lets herself be judged and arranged, and whose circumference we can grasp. I had to accept that what I had previously called my soul was not at all my soul, but a dead system. Hence, I had to speak to my soul as to something far off and unknown, which did not exist through me, but through whom I existed. Thus begins Liber Novus. This was not a literary experiment, a literary experience. It was not an imaginative musing. It was an exploration, a quest, a journey in search of a fact sensed but not known. And Jung fully dedicated himself to that task. He turned to his soul, the mystery of the psyche. He addressed her. But he had no specific image of who or what he was addressing. This was beyond the boundaries of his dead system of knowledge. He had no picture, no map. He had to discover what a soul was. What he sought, the image and voice he addressed, at this point still remained to him totally veiled. The first entry is November 12th. On November 14th, two nights later, he calls out again. And here, let me explain something to you. Jung is a busy man. He's not sitting in his study, drooling with a pen in hand, removed from the activities of daily life. During this period, Jung is seeing, on average, six patients a day. He sees patients in the morning before lunch and then after a two-hour break again in the afternoon. He is lecturing. He is continuing with his scientific activities. He is writing. He has a wife and family to care for, and he does. He's in the Swiss Army. And then, as now, he had obligatory service to give, which he did. He took all of his libido, that's the word he uses. In Jungian terms, it means simply energy. He took all of his energies that he put into his daily activity. And then at night, alone in his room, he tried to turn exactly that amount of energy, that amount of concentration, the same amounts of energy he was putting into the exterior world. And this was quite a bit, to take that energy and give the same amount of interest, concentration, energy to his quest to understand his soul. And so, on this second night, November 14th, he continues. On the second night, I called out to my soul, "I am weary, my soul. My wandering has lasted too long. My search for myself outside of myself. Now, I have gone through events and find you behind all of them. For I made discoveries on my erring through events, humanity, and the world. I found men, and you, my soul, I found again. First in images within men, and then you, yourself. I found you where I least expected you. You climbed out of a dark shaft. You announced yourself to me in advance in dreams. They burned in my heart and drove me to the boldest acts of daring and forced me to rise above myself. You let me see truths of which I had no previous inkling. You let me undertake journeys whose endless length would have scared me if the knowledge of them had not been secure in you. I wandered for many years, so long that I forgot that I possessed a soul. I belonged to men and things. I did not belong to myself. Where were you all this time? Which beyond sheltered you and gave you sanctuary? How should I decipher you?" And then he asks a question of his soul. He asks, "Who are you, child? My dreams have represented you as a child and as a maiden. I am ignorant of your mystery. Look, I bear a wound that is as yet not healed. My ambition to make an impression. Forgive me if I speak as in a dream, like a drunkard. Are you God? Is God like a child? A maiden? Are you God? How strange it sounds to me to call you a child. You who still hold the all without end in your hand. How thick the earlier darkness was. How impetuous and how egotistic my passion was, subjugated by all the diamonds of ambition, the desire for glory, greed, uncharitableness, zeal. How ignorant I was at that time. Life tore me away, and I deliberately moved away from you, and I have done so for all these years. I thought that you were lost, even though I sometimes thought I was lost. But you were not lost. I went on the way of the day. You went invisibly with me and guided me step by step, putting the pieces together meaningfully and letting me see the whole in each part. Jung did not know what was about to happen. He had no concept of what the soul was. Oh, well, maybe he did have a concept. Maybe he had known in his dead science, his dead system, a theory of psyche. But that wasn't the point here. This was an exploration. He went to know, to find, to see, to meet, and to understand. He went on the next night. What strange things are happening to me? Where are you leading me? Forgive my excessive apprehension, brimful of knowledge. My foot hesitates to follow you. Into what mist and darkness does your path lead? I limp after you on crutches of understanding. I am a man, and you stride like a god. What torture. I must return to myself, to the smallest things. I saw the things of my soul as small and pitiably small. You force me to see them as large, to make them large. Is that your aim? I follow, but it terrifies me. Hear my doubts, otherwise I cannot follow. Since your meaning is a supreme meaning, and your steps are the steps of a god, I should give myself completely into your hands. But who are you? I do not trust you. Not once to trust. Is that my love for you? My joy in you? Forget my doubts. I know it is ignoble to doubt you. You know how difficult it is for me to set aside the beggar's pride I take in my own thought. I forgot that you are also one of my friends and have the first right to my trust. Should what I give them not belong to you, I recognize my injustice. At this point, the conversation is proceeding fairly one-sidedly. Jung senses the reality of his soul. He has made an effort to address her. She seems a she, feminine. He sat at his desk these nights. He says for 25 nights he sat there, between the beginnings of November and December of 1913. Listening, probing, trying to find a word, an image, a pathway. The man had no map. He didn't know where the doorway to this realm was. He says, during six further nights, the spirit of the depths was silent in me, since I swayed between fear and defiance and nausea, and was wholly the prey of my passion. I could not and did not want to listen to the depths. But on the seventh night, the spirit of the depths spoke to me. He heard these words. Look into your depths. Pray to your depths. Waken the dead. Jung continues, but I stood helpless and did not know what I could do. I looked into myself, and the only thing I found within was the memory of earlier dreams, all of which I wrote down without knowing what good this would do. I wanted to throw everything away and return to the light of day, but the spirit stopped me and forced me back into myself. In 1925, Jung gave a seminar attended by, I think, about a dozen people. And many of these individuals in 1925, knew something about his journey, this journey of exploration. And people wanted to know more about it, because, you see, this is not something he had spoken about publicly. There were people who were close to him during these years, patients, who he conveyed parts of his story to, a very, very few who knew it all, who had actually read his drafts of the Red Book. And so in 25, he gave a seminar over the course of several weeks in which he tried to explain what had happened to him. It was the one record we had until the publication of the Red Book that, quite close to the event itself, laid out his journey. And he tried to describe at that point his situation at this moment in the journey, December of 1913. He told the seminar, "Not knowing what would come next, I thought perhaps more introspection was needed. When we introspect, we look within ourselves and see if there is anything to be observed. And if there is nothing, we may either give up the introspective process, or find a way of boring through it to the material that escapes the first survey. I devised such a boring method by fantasizing that I was digging a hole, and by accepting this fantasy as perfectly real. This is naturally somewhat difficult to do. To believe so thoroughly in a fantasy that it leads you into further fantasy. Just as if you were digging a real hole and passing from one discovery to another. But when I began on that hole, I worked and worked so hard that I knew something had to come of it. That fantasy had to produce and lure out other fantasies." You see, it's a sort of technique. He didn't know what to do. And so he sat there at his desk and simply entered into an image. A man with a shovel digging, 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 deep into the earth, letting his vision actually concentrate entirely upon the object of that fantasy. And something happened. The date was December 12th. This is in the Red Book. This is 1 month after the process. The petition had started. "Finally, I felt I'd come to a place where I could go no further down. I said to myself that, that being the case, I would dig horizontally. And then it seemed as if I were in a corridor. And as though I were wading into black slime. I went in thinking to myself that this was the remnant of an old mind. And then he was there. In vision, in fantasy, he was there. He saw entry to a cave or a grotto. By the doorway, there was a withered dwarf. He squeezed by the dwarf into the entry. Within, he saw a small alcove on the wall. A jewel was in the alcove. He heard the rush of water. He went to the stone. He picked it up. He looked in. There, below, was a mysterious river. He saw float by a dead body with a wound on the head, a scarab, and then a sun glowing from the deep waters. And as the sun passed, thousands of serpents began crawling down the walls of that cavern, wrapping themselves around the sun. Then, where he'd picked the stone up, a spurt of blood started emerging. He tried to put the stone back to stop it. And the vision was over. There he was, at his desk. He continues, speaking in 1925 about the event. When I came out of the fantasy, I realized that my mechanism had worked wonderfully well. But I was in great confusion as to the meaning of all those things I had seen. Jung says he was confused. He had no conceptual framework for what he would encounter on this exploration. Of course, he had, in earlier life, seen a few scraps of maps of this realm. But it was unclear quite how they fit together. He had heard hints about the terrain of the hidden world, the psychic world, from his patients, some of whom were labeled as incurably insane. He had had visions as a child. He was entering a forgotten world, a place as close as the beating heart in his breast, and yet as distant as the faintest stars of heaven. Everything he had held as a theoretical concept had to be discarded before the reality of this experience. He continued in his descriptions of what he was doing. And this is not in the Red Book. This is actually, he related to Anilia Yaffe near the end of his life as he was talking about these events. They're recorded in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, which we find now in light of the Red Book to be a very accurate, though incomplete, summary of the events of this time. Something that some biographers at one point questioned. In order to grasp the fantasies which were stirring in me underground, I knew I had to let myself plummet down into them, as it were. I felt not only violent resistance to this, but a distinct fear. For I was afraid of losing command of myself and becoming a prey to the fantasies. And, as a psychiatrist, I realized only too well what that meant. After prolonged hesitation, however, I saw that there was no other way. I had to take the chance, had to try to gain power over them, for I realized that if I did not, I ran the risk of their gaining power over me. A cogent motive for my making the attempt was the conviction that I could not expect my patients to do something I did not dare to do myself. The excuse that a helper stood at their side would not pass muster, for I was well aware that the so-called helper, that is, myself, could not help them unless he knew their fantasy material from his own direct experience, and that at present all he possessed were a few theoretical prejudices of dubious value. This idea that I was committing myself to a dangerous experiment, not for myself alone, but also for the sake of my patients, helped me over several critical phases. As Dr. Shyam Dasani notes in his editorial comments to the Red Book, it's clear that at this point, Jung's procedure, what he was doing, was entirely intentional. The man was attempting, at this point, to release vision. Visions. Hallucinations. He he recalled that beneath the threshold of consciousness, there was an animated fact. It revealed itself in dreams. He was trying to get to it even more directly. Three nights later, the vision opened up in power and intensity. Jung met Salome and Elijah. He had conversations with them both. Intense and meaningful events occurred. At the end of his several night encounter, his vision of Salome and Elijah, he found himself actually crucified, hung on a cross and wrapped by a serpent. Not just crucified, Christified. When that vision started, he said that he felt, and he said this in 1925, it's recorded again in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, he felt that he had fallen not just a short distance into the earth, he felt that he had fallen to the edge of the cosmos itself at the beginning of this vision, the vision of Salome and Elijah, one of the principal visions. He calls it the Mysterium Encounter. Mysterium, the mystery, the great mystery. In the Red Book. I cannot relate the entirety of that vision to you tonight, and I will not try. What I want to talk about is the technique of vision itself, because I said, you see, that this was an exploration, that Jung was seeing things, that he was having visions. Well, what the hell is that? Each and every one of you, I'm sure, have had dreams, lucid, intense dreams, that you can remember. If I tell you right now, remember a dream. You probably can. Have you been in a dream that seemed entirely real? Completely and entirely real? While you were in it? What you saw was tangible? Had color, feeling, smell, voices spoke to you. Things gave you joy, satisfaction, terror, tears. You laughed, you screamed, you talked, you heard. And then you come back, you see, from the dream, into daylight consciousness, awakeness, and veils fall one after the other, after the other, after the other. Some dreams are so powerful, so intense, that they shake us right out of our sleep at that moment, and we wake up fully cognizant of them. But they fade. Others, more common dreams, the dreams of last night, disappear quickly behind veils. We work, we focus, intent upon grasping back at them, if we wish, in consciousness. And even with that focused intent, the images fade. What Jung was attempting to do is remove the veil of dream. To meet the psyche, to meet the dream image, the imaginal, the visionary, in his full consciousness, in full awakeness. And he was developing a technique. In later Jungian therapy, the technique was called active imagination. But you see, using that word is so inappropriate at this moment, because at this moment, there was no Jungian terminology. Jungian terminology, as it existed later, started with an experience, with Jung's experience. I've heard a very prominent Jungian therapist talking about the Red Book. I've heard a couple of them, actually. And they keep using this terminology of Jungian psychology, developed by Jung, yes, much later. His outlines of a map to refer to the experience. Well, yes, his soul, that's his anima. And, yes, this vision, that's an active imagination. As if those words encapsulated the experience, the event. They don't. They certainly didn't for Jung. The words were bred by the experience, by the exploration. They were pieces of the map he drew. Speaking about his technique of vision, Jung spoke to a young woman, a very interesting woman by the name of Christiana Morgan. a fascinating lady who went to Jung around 1926. I think she was about 30 at the time, for analysis. Christiana Morgan was one of the few people that Jung met who seemed to have the same ability, potential, to bring about waking visions, to induce waking visions, these imaginations, and enter into them in full consciousness. And in his discourse with Christiana and in her diaries of their sessions together, she took these notes of what Jung had told her. She had sent Jung some of her initial attempts at evoking the state of a vision, of imagination. And he wrote back to her about her early writings, her early examples of what she was doing. He said, "They are only beginnings," referring to what she had sent him. "You only use the retina of the eye at first in order to objectify. Then instead of keeping on trying to force the image out, you just look in. Now, when you see these images, you want to hold them and see where they take you, how they change. And you want to try to get yourself into the picture yourself, to become one of the actors. When I first began to do this, I saw landscapes. Then I learned how to put myself in the landscape, and figures would talk to me, and I would answer them. Vision. Oh, excuse me. Who have visions? Who have visions? Madmen. Or prophets. What the hell was he? A madman? A prophet. You know, there's the old joke that the difference between a madman and a mystic is the mystic knows who not to tell about his experiences. And you know, there is great truth in that. And maybe by that definition, since Jung kept his red book hidden throughout his life, and for 50 years after his death, we should not apply the nomer madman to him all too quickly. He tried to explain what he was doing. And in fact, he developed a technique which was called active imagination. And he worked with patients, trying to bring others into this same ability, this visionary ability, which was really root base of the visions that composed the Red Book. And I only just barely scratched the first few pages of the book in my readings tonight. He was very fond, Jung, very fond of Meister Eckhart, a great German mystic of the Middle Ages. In describing his technique, he wrote later in his collected works, many years later, he says, letting things happen, action through non-action, the letting go of oneself, of Meister Eckhart, became the key for me that succeeded in opening the door to the way. One must be able to psychically let things happen. Looking at the Red Book, when it first was published, I heard several individuals say, "My God, what was that man smoking?" And others, actually a radio show I was listening to on NPR, he said, "You know, this looks hallucinogenic. It looks like Tolkien." Those comments I've seen repeated again and again. Hallucinogenic? Well, it's interesting because Jung made a comment on just that subject. It's quoted by Dr. Shamdasani in his introduction. And I don't know if these are the exact words. They're taken from the words of Jung, spoken to Anyala Yafe, his secretary, late in life. And Shamdasani says, "In retrospect, Jung recalled that his scientific question was to see what took place when he switched off consciousness. The example of dreams indicated the existence of background activity, and he wanted to give this a possibility of emerging, just as one does when taking mescaline. Now, I should make clear that Jung wasn't taking mescaline. But he certainly, in his later life, was aware of such things, of hallucinogens, of mescaline and LSD. LSD. Whenever I say those letters in Utah, I have to check and make sure I got it. Not to cause offense, I have actually gotten it. Did I get it right? Yeah, okay. LSD was invented in Switzerland. I mean, Albert Hoffman was, you know, a neighbor of Jung's. Figuratively speaking. So he was aware of this. But Jung said, actually, on several occasions, there are several letters where he wrote about this. One to Victor White, in which he was not so interested in it. Another comment he made to a dear friend of his last years by the name of Lawrence Vonderpost, a great, great man himself, a great author. And author, I think, of one of the most heartfelt biographies of Jung. I think it's called C.G. Jung, His Myth in Our Time. Unfortunately, when I last checked, it was out of print. It's been out of print for 10 years, but it's a wonderful book if you can find a used copy. He said to Lawrence Vonderpost, I would fear for myself if I were to do that, to take such a substance, because I am naturally so open to these things. But you see, the chemical pathways of our brains, well, they can be stimulated. Throughout human history, it has been known that there are techniques of stimulating altered levels of consciousness. Meditation techniques were part of the mystical practice throughout Western Christianity's history. And they have, God knows, a longer, much longer history and development in the East. Jung was not using any one of these particular techniques. He was discovering for himself the path. But what you do have to understand about the Red Book is it's the record of visions. And these were not, once again, literary exercises. He wasn't musing at his desk, twiddling away. When he was in the vision, he was there. He was speaking to the prophet Elijah, to Salome. He was on that cross. He received a crown. He felt the pain, the horror. He said of this experience, I was frequently so wrought up that I had to do certain yoga exercises in order to hold my emotions in check. But since it was my purpose to know what was going on within myself, I had to do these exercises only until I had calmed myself enough to resume my work with the unconscious. As soon as I had the feeling that I was again myself, I abandoned this restraint upon the emotions and allowed the images and inner voices to speak afresh. To speak afresh. That's the beginning of the Red Book, the beginning of the exploration. I could quickly summarize the events that follow. But you see, if I were just to try to tell you a story, give you a plot synopsis, I'd be giving you nothing of value. You have to go there with the man. Sit down with this book and read. Understand that what you are reading is unlike any literary creation, unlike any scientific document, unlike any fantasy novel you might possess. just as the book itself in size, magnitude, and wonder is unlike anything else you probably possess of written nature. These are visions. These visions led Jung deep into mystery. Deeper and deeper still they went. In later life, when Jung spoke of archetypes, when he spoke of contents of a collective, objective psyche, a collective unconscious, he was not propounding theory. He knew. He had seen. He had explored. In the collected works, you will find these visions again and again reflected in the documentation, in the essay, in the focus of what he says. Though he mentions them not, they were his secret. They gave him the map that he used to order a psychology. They were the source of a vocabulary, a technical mechanism of describing the geography, not of a theoretical construct, but of a place where Carl Gustav Jung had been. Things he had seen. Jung, explorer of the human soul and its hidden depths. Thank you.